I want to share some reflections this evening and to begin with appreciation for all of you here, all of us who have been here together since yesterday, and we also have quite a few guests from the Hermitage, which is always nice to see, so welcome. Long-term practitioners and also some of the coordinators are here. So, yeah, really wonderful to have such a full hall. And yeah, for all of us here on this particular journey of this retreat, yeah, see if you can kind of take a deep breath of appreciation for yourself. 24 hours done. And it takes a lot of courage, and it takes a lot of dedication, it takes a lot of heart to show up to our experience, to show up to our lives, as we've been doing. And sometimes it maybe might feel like, I haven't been doing such a good job of it. So I am saying here, with these two behind me, mm-hmm. they're backing, you're doing great. Yeah. And there's so much in just being here and showing up to this complex undertaking called day one of a meditation retreat, with everything that comes up. The body and the heart and mind. It's really worth acknowledging and appreciating. So this kind of leads into one aspect that I wanted to speak about today, which is maybe the main thread of pretty much whenever I offer a teaching. So apologies if you've heard it before, maybe numerous times. And it's the fact that whenever we have an experience, whenever we have an experience, whether it's first day of a retreat or this moment right now with this knee pain or back pain or heartache, whenever there's an experience, it is shaped. Yeah. And it's shaped by two factors that we're interested in. What we're paying attention to, and how we're paying attention. What am I paying attention to, and how am I paying attention? What is the way of relating? What's the quality that is at play in how I'm relating to a particular experience? And we can see this in our meditation practice. You know, the beauty of meditation practice is it's a simplification of experience to a great degree, and it allows us to see these things. Yeah? So what are the instructions that we've been giving you? I know that they haven't been that clear, so you're still figuring out, and rightly so, what am I supposed to do? Yeah. But the instructions are, there's an anchor of attention. Yeah? The anchor could be the breath, could be the body, could be the metta, phrases or intention. And there is how I'm paying attention to that. Yeah, we've been emphasizing interest and kindness as ways of relating. Yeah? Does that make sense now? Okay, I can be quiet now for the next 3 days. You got it? Keep going. You're on the right track. I know there was some sense of relief. Some of you ever thought that we'd be quiet, but this is our role, to sit here and talk. So we can see this in our practice, but it's actually operating all the time. Yeah? Whenever there's an experience, we hear something, we see something, we think something, we feel something, we taste something. There's an object in attention, there's something that attention is focused on. Yeah? And there's a way of relating to that experience, which includes our mind states, our moods. Yeah? Sometimes we call it the atmosphere of our attention. And most of the time, the way of relating, or all of the time in a kind of our habitual way of being in the world is habitual. These are just patterns that are playing out and we don't notice them because they're habits. You don't notice that there's a way of relating that's impacting our experience, that's impacting how we're seeing life at this moment, or how we're seeing something in particular in this moment. So an example of this may be, I think I mentioned that I'd been on retreat for a few days before teaching this retreat. And just before being on retreat, as happens, may have happened to you, just before coming on retreat, someone said something that hurt my feelings. Yeah? Very random. And then on retreat, the thought comes up, oh, they said that. And the habitual way of relating to that thought, oh, they said that, is, and that says something about me. Yeah? And the identification with that thought, they said that, that means something about me. Yeah? Does that make sense? Yeah, this identification is also a way of relating, this owning something. Something someone said, or something we feel. And so, what we're interested in, to see, is what happens when we intentionally bring into our awareness, and that's what we're doing when we practice, that there is a way of relating, shaping our experience. Just remembering that. Just remembering that. There's a way of relating, shaping experience right now, in this moment. There is a way of relating, shaping your experience right now, in this moment. Yeah? I'm saying it to you now. Now. And now. Yeah. There is. And one of the things that we develop in our practice is we become more sensitive to the habitual ways of relating that our heart and mind tend to groove into. We also become more flexible and shifting. So we become sensitive. Ah, there's a way, we remember there's a way of relating. We kind of know what the usual suspects may be. So we can acknowledge, we can notice, and then we can also change. We can also incline the mind somewhere else. But we'll get there. First, a story. It's one of my favourite teaching stories, therefore it's appeared in talks before. I'm going to stop saying that. Just know. Probably everything I'm saying I've said before. What's the way of relating now? So this is a story from Ram Dass. It's a story about him going to have a family dinner with his family. He's already grown up. He's going to have family dinner with his parents and his brother and his brother's wife. I think that's who's there. And he acknowledges on the way there that there's a particular dynamic in his family, particularly between him and his brother, which is that they exchanged barbed comments. That's the dynamic. And so he remembers this, acknowledges this, and he happens to be in a very spacious frame of mind, not to do with any of his recreational habits. Yes, it does, but anyway. So he's in a very spacious frame of mind, and he sits down to dinner, and lo and behold, his brother says to him, "What's with that haircut?" or something. I haven't read the story in a while, so I'm kind of improvising, something like that. That's with that haircut. And in Ram Dass's perception, because he's kind of acknowledged beforehand, these are the habitual ways that we relate to each other, and actually they are dukkha, they are suffering, and I want to do something different. So he comes with that intention, and as his brother is saying that to him, he's imagining seeing like an arrow go from his brother's mouth, heading towards him. And the habit is to shoot an arrow back. Now, that's the habit, and he knows the habit, but he wants to do something different. So he says to his brother, "Oh, you know, I really like that shirt you're wearing today. Instead of an arrow, there's a heart that's going out to meet there." And this keeps going, yeah? The brother is in his habit. He's, you know, saying the usual comments. And Ram Dass keeps responding, yeah, with different comments, saying, "Oh, you know, I really, it's really nice to see you and your wife together in this kind of very supportive way." Yeah. And this keeps going through the meal. And what he says in the story is that by the end of that meal, next to Ram Dass's plate, there's an imaginary pile of arrows, yeah, that he's just plucked out of the air and put down with his heart. And the whole dinner table, yeah, is in a warm, loving atmosphere. Yeah? So those kind of loving comments, yeah, eventually have an impact, not just on his brother sitting opposite him, but on the parents and the sister-in-law, everyone that's there. And so we have a habit. We have so many habits. Yeah? And this is a family-conditioned habit, but they're often quite ingrained in other situations as well. Yeah. And this habit, if someone says something that feels like an arrow that's coming to me, I will respond in the same way. Yeah. It's a habit that many of us maybe know in some situations. Acknowledging that and saying, "I'm not going to follow that, I'm going to do something else. I'm going to do something different. And I'm going to do something that is not just random, but it actually aligns, you know, with what matters to me. It aligns with why I come to family dinner, you know. My partner calls my family's family events family torture." Yeah, sometimes they're like that, aren't they? My family's great, but it can get like that. You know, family torture. So we're not coming for family torture. We're coming because, you know, we want to be with people that we love. Yeah? So that's the intention. Can we align with our intention? And as he aligns with his intention and acts on it, his experience changes, and also the experience of those around him changes. Yeah? This is really significant, meaningful, because it opens up possibilities for us. Become familiar with our experience. This is in Tibetan, the word for meditation, gom, means to become familiar. We become familiar with our experience. We become familiar with our habitual ways of relating and where they lead. And we become familiar with our intentions and what would support them to manifest in the world. So, as I was saying, habitually our ways of relating to experience are habitual, they're conditioned, they're patterns that repeat themselves, and we're interested to get to know them. Yeah? Why? So that we can attend more skillfully to our experience. And we can see in the Ram Dass story that habitual way of competitiveness, yeah, competition, which includes aversion, aversion to aversive kind of speech, and includes also a desire, to show I'm better than, something like that. And I'm mentioning aversion and desire. Aversion's been mentioned quite a few times already, hasn't it? I wonder what it says about Asura. But I'm mentioning aversion and desire because they are two out of five really common ways of relating that we meet in our meditation practice quite a lot. Any guesses what these five are? Who's familiar with the lists of the Buddha? Five hindrances, drum roll, obstacles, things that obstruct. Sometimes in today's Dharma teaching, contemporary Dharma teaching, we actually call them the five visitors or the five guests. Yeah. And again, we're changing the way of relating to the way of relating when we do that. Yeah. can be really skillful to do. And I'm sure you're familiar with probably all five, but I would guess at least three, you know, for each of you from today, just from today. So I'm going to name them. So we have aversion and desire already. Yeah, they're a pair, two sides of a coin. Yeah, and there's aversion to something, there's desire for something else. Do you ever notice that? And there's desire for something, there's aversion, yeah, to something as well. Yeah. I want to have, you know, that deep state of meditation that I read about or I had once. I have aversion to whatever state of mind there is right now. Yeah? Two sides of a coin. Make sense? So that's the first pair. Aversion and desire. The second is restlessness, you know, agitation. It includes mental agitation and physical agitation. And its partner, low energy, yeah, dullness of mind or low energy in the body. Yeah. And these are a pairing because there's actually a spectrum between the two. Yeah? They're both a kind of a mix of calm and energy. Yeah? So when there's restlessness, there's a lot of energy with not enough calm. Yeah? That's an imbalance. When there's dullness and tiredness, it's quite a calm state until aversion kicks in. But there's not a lot of energy. Yeah? So it's an imbalance in that direction. And kind of the optimal state that we like to be in is when calm and energy are balanced, yeah, somewhere in the middle. So it can be helpful to see that pairing as a pair as well. And the fifth hindrance is doubt. Doubt, confusion. Yeah. Which, yeah, recently we were just talking about it. We can sometimes see, you know, we say doubt sometimes in the hall when we speak about the hindrance, and it's a little bit hard to, we get it, but it's a little bit difficult to really get it. So we could see it as the absence of a sense of confidence. Yeah? When we're not confident, yeah, in what we're doing, in why we're doing it. Yeah? And that's a kind of another way of talking about doubt. Now I'm going to relate to all of these five as ways of relating. Why? Because when they're present, they colour and shape our experience. Yeah? Whatever we see, yeah, via a mind state of aversion, or a mind state of desire, or a mind state of restlessness, or a mind state of dullness, yeah, or a mind state of doubt, whatever we meet via that mind state will be coloured, will be shaped a particular way. This is not an original thing I'm saying. The guy behind me, Buddha, said it before. And one of their similes for the hindrances really, really describes this beautifully. One of my favorite teachings. So in this simile, the Buddha's describing our mind as a clear vessel of water, a pot of water. I like to, you know, if you noticed, I like to improvise, so I like to kind of think of it as a pool in the forest, yeah, but with clear water. When the mind is aligned, yeah, when the mind is settled, when the mind is collected, it's like clear water, yeah, a beautiful forest pool. When desire is present in the mind, said the Buddha, it's as if someone threw a dye into the water. Mm-hmm. And the water is coloured. For some reason, in my mind, it's always the colour purple. I don't know why. Yeah. Water is coloured by that dye. Which means that whatever we perceive in a mind state of desire, yeah, will be coloured by that desire. When there's aversion in the mind, it's as if the water is boiling. It's boiling. Yeah. It's a great image. Yeah. When there is dullness in the mind, it's as if there's a vegetation growing across the whole of the surface, and kind of it's all stagnant, yeah, and it's kind of suffocating, yeah, the pool and the water. When there's restlessness, it's as if there's a strong wind blowing, and we had a good one of that today, and there's waves across the surface of the water constantly. Again, all of these are obscuring. Yeah? We can't see through them. What we see is the hindrance. And when there's doubt, it's as if someone put their hand right into the bottom of that pool and stirred up all the mud, yeah, at the bottom. And all we see is murky, muddiness. Sound like a doubtful mind to you? It's really a lot like mine. So it's really interesting, and you know, I think the simile is wonderful, because we can see how when hindrances are present and they're a strong example of ways of relating, ways of looking, when they're present, they colour the lens of perception, yeah, and they shape what we then see. What we see and how we see it. They're also, when they go unseen and they impact our experience in these ways, pretty guaranteed they will impact our experience in the direction of dukkha-ville. Yeah. Dukkha, stress, distress, dissatisfaction, yeah, unease, ill-being, yeah, aversion, desire, sensual desire here. Restlessness, tiredness, doubt, if they're unseen and unattended to, they will colour our experience in those ways. So let's just test the waters and also get a bit of energy in the hall, hopefully, as we do that. Just for fun, who's experienced dullness today, sloth and turbo in the traditional language? Anyone? Yeah, you've got to look around, people. Yeah. This is great. This is the best it's ever been in the hall. Yeah, we did really well on this one today. Fantastic. Good job, Laura. Yeah. All right. Anyone experienced restlessness today? And you know, it's okay if we don't feel like you have to raise your hand so we get like a really big thing. If you did, yeah, got some restlessness. Yeah. Aversion, anyone? Yeah. Favorite. And sensual desire. Dreams of that cup of tea. Or warmth. Yeah, wonderful. Yeah. And our good old friend doubt. Yeah. The master, the mistress of the hindrances. Yeah. Some moments at least. Yeah. So it's just really helpful, and this is one of the things that whenever you next experience a hindrance, yeah, and you find yourself believing what it's telling you, and you find yourself believing that it says something about you, because these hindrances are sticky. And we identify, we hook into them, and we believe what they tell us, and we believe that they're saying something about us. Remember all those hands. Yeah? It's not just about you, it's not yours, it's not personal. It's something the human heart and mind just grooves, gravitates towards. A habit that we've developed. So these are expressions of dukkha leading to dukkha when they're unattended to. A really important aspect to remember. And if we go back to Ram Dass and we think, what supported that shift, yeah, that he made in the way of relating? What supported that shift in that story? We can see there was an intention of metta. Yeah? We connected to an intention of metta there. No, there's a strong habit of this, but what I really want is to come and connect with my family in that case. Yeah, a strong intention of friendship, of goodwill, and then doing the work, yeah, to bring it forth. And that intention of metta comes along with its sisters. I mentioned today, I call them the four sisters, the the Brahma Viharas, that's kind of how I talk to them in my own mind, comes together with compassion for the painful, you know, that ouch when someone becomes sensitive sometimes, and we come with metta, it can be more of an ouch when someone is saying something not very nice to us, yeah? And then we can bring compassion to ourselves, yeah? He's bringing compassion to himself, bringing compassion to the other. Yeah? You don't really mean that. Bringing in appreciation, yeah? Mudita, the third Brahma Vihara, appreciation, gratitude, you know, just seeing what can I say, you know, not just lying, saying what can I say to my brother right now that is appreciative. Yeah? We start with the shirt and then we get to more significant things, perhaps. So we'll bring that in. And there's also the equanimity. The equanimity of not reacting, of not getting pulled in to that reactivity that the habits pull us towards. And that not getting pulled in, the staying steady, the holding the space, allows a different response to come through. And it's interesting to see, and hopefully we can begin to see it, each of these four sisters, each of these immeasurable qualities of heart and mind, they bring the opposite of dukkha. So if we said, you know, the hindrances of dukkha builders when they go unattended to, the immeasurables, they are sukha builders, yeah? Opposite of dukkha, and deeper than that, yeah? Well-being, release, ease. And we can turn towards them, which is what we're doing in our practice. We can bring them alive again and again, bring them into being again and again. Yeah? It's our practice to do that, and also to notice what happens when I look this way. What happens when I look with metta? Happens to experience? How does that shape what I see? So hindrances will arise. They're part of the human condition. And I kind of was emphasizing on retreat, but it's not just some retreat. They're part of our psyche. And they arise all the time. It's just from retreat we have the conditions to really see them, to notice them. So hindrances will arise, but that's not the end of the story. It's the beauty of this path, that it gives us an onward leading possibility. We can bring interest to how the hindrances impact our experience. We can bring interest to how we habitually react to them, and we can bring interest to what other possibilities we have. Yeah. So it's kind of noticing that there's a hindrance, and if you're feeling kind of in dukkhaville, likely there's a hindrance around, so look for it. And sometimes it's enough just to know, there's a hindrance at play. Interested to see how that impacts experience. And interesting to see that we habitually react to them with more hindrances. Yeah. Particularly, initially with aversion, because they're unpleasant states, or with the other side of the coin, the desire for this to go away. Yeah. And we might then find ourselves in a daydream or a fantasy, of like, when I finally get rid of this hindrance of aversion, or restlessness, or tiredness. So then it kind of builds up. Yeah? The desire and the aversion are the two most common ways of relating reactivity to the hindrances. And they come with that belief in the limitation. You know, this is really here. So I need to struggle with it, to push and pull against it. And this is what's happening. And this one is important, so listen. And it's the only thing that is happening. Yeah. It's also something that our mind does. There's aversion, and we feel like there's only aversion, or there's only the object, that the aversion is building up around. That's the only thing that's happening. And it's happening to me. To me. It's happening to me. Or to you, in that case. So we notice all of that. This is so insightful to see. Because when we see it, we can change. We can cultivate ways of changing. So, example of having a discomfort in the body. So there may be discomfort in the body, we'll relate to it with aversion. We don't want it. We'll relate to it with desire for the absence of pain. And most likely that will escalate, as I was just saying, to restlessness or into tiredness, which is sometimes our get out of jail card. With unpleasant, we just fall asleep. And we don't have to deal with it. And we can remember, this is the habit. What other possibilities are there? What happens when we remember? With kindness and interest, remember? Kindness and interest. This is a hindrance. It's not who I am. And I don't need to believe the story it's telling me right now. It's just a habit of heart and mind. And it's not even my habit. It's a human habit. What happens when we ask ourselves, what else is here? Or what else is possible? So if we're working with the discomfort in the body, then we ask that question. We can openly explore, is there anywhere in the body that is not uncomfortable right now? And for most of us, a lot of the time there will be somewhere that is not in pain. Whether it's the little finger or, it's, both the arms or, it could be a very large, it could be most of our body that's actually not in pain. And maybe it's only the knee that's hurting right now, but all the attention is going there with aversion. Or we could meet the painful with compassion. We could relate to it differently, and we'll be talking more about that tomorrow. So how does that change the experience? And it changes it radically. From that aversion, the pushing away, the rejection, to a tenderness. That's holding that. That's caring for it. So any way of relating can be changed. Any hindrance can be attended to with metta. We can change the way of relating, even if it's just for a fleeting moment. That's a moment of relief, that's a moment of release. And those moments build up into other habits of mind than the ones that we have habitually inherited from the human species. This is what we do when we practice. So any hindrance can be attended to with metta, with compassion, with appreciation, with equanimity. With that, the support of all of those to bring in interest, investigation, and playfulness. And so we hold it. It's really so helpful to hold the engagement with metta and compassion, appreciation and equanimity. Otherwise, it builds into aversion. And working with this hindrance so it goes away. We're holding that in that field of the Brahmaviharas, that field of compassion and friendliness. And then we can begin to investigate. So if there's tiredness, you can explore and look, what happens if I start to work with that tiredness through the body space? I maybe attend to the posture. Do you notice? You maybe didn't see. I just talk about it and my posture changes. If you can see it from a distance, If I'm tired, that tends to happen to us with tiredness as we go like that. So we can learn from that. So have the opposite. Open the chest. Lower the shoulders. Open the space. Uprightness that is not rigid. Energizes. We can play with the sense of space. Yeah, this helps with tiredness, it also helps with restlessness, interestingly enough. Increasing the space, the whole body, like we've been doing. Yeah? And sometimes even bigger than the body, the whole room. Did you know your awareness could be as big as the whole room? Yeah, you did. Yeah, because that's what happens to it when you take in the whole room, the growth. It can be as big as the whole grounds. It can be as big as the whole world. And so when we open the space, all spaciousness, that already impacts any of the hindrances, but particularly the imbalances of calm and energy. The too much energy, too little energy. We can utilize how we breathe. Yeah, it's another way of working with the body. Yeah. We can breathe in a way that's soothing, or calming if there's too much restlessness. We can breathe in a way that's enlivening if we're feeling dull. Yeah. We can play with the breath in those ways. We can ground. Yeah, really helpful when there's a lot of doubt, actually. Sense of ground. We've been doing at the beginning of practices as well. The sense of spaciousness also helps with the aversion and the desire, because it just opens up to what else is here. When the space grows, more things can be included. And so we're kind of unhooking the attention from that gravitation that it will have on the object or on the hindrance itself. So one way that we can see our practice is a phrase that my partner came up with a while ago, and we use it a lot, and see Dharma practice as remembering the possibility of possibilities. The possibility of possibilities. Which means there's always a possibility to attend to our experience in ways that incline to the wholesome, that incline to more well-being. And this means that there's always a possibility to recognize the way of relating that's at play, to understand its impact, and to incline to a more skillful and more wholesome way of relating, that which leads to well-being rather than away from it. That which brings release, spaciousness and well-being, as opposed to that which brings contraction, limitation and friction, struggle with our experience. So I can't remember if I've said it already, but I'm going to repeat myself countless times anyway, so here's one more. Metta, compassion, joy and equanimity are also ways of relating to experience. There's ways of relating to experience, and there's some of the most wholesome ways of relating to experience that are available to us as human beings. They are ways of cultivating freedom and release. Our deepest heart's desire. There are ways of cultivating that, of bringing that forth, bringing that into being. And they are also expressions of freedom and release. And I want to close with one of my favorite quotes. Buddha describing a mind imbued with any of the Brahmaviharas, any of these immeasurable qualities. And the Buddha says, a mind imbued with metta, compassion, mudita, or equanimity, upekkha, is abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. A mind imbued with metta, compassion, mudita, or equanimity is abundant, exalted, immeasurable. Without hostility and without ill will. Isn't that worth working towards? And it's possible, yeah, for each of us, this is what these teachings remind us of, possible for each of us in every moment where we have even a fragrance of this possibility. It's a moment of great preciousness for our own hearts and minds and for the world. So this is possible for us. Let's have a moment of quiet together to bring this to a close.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.